without further ado, Sri Kamalji.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Thank you, Tarya. And I'm told this room is for PhD defense, among other things. So it is, feels like I'm going to defend my thesis. Why do I want to think about ethics in relation to interpreting data, which is a methodological, rigorous activity that we all do, and we don't necessarily have to think about ethics. So that's what I want to talk about, ethics of interpretation in qualitative research. Of course, it can be extended to quantitative research, but basically I'll focus because that's where I feel comfortable. I can also see that the alternative is to play music, and but I'm not good at that, so I'll stick with this side of the room. Okay, this is part of a conversation I thought from last year when we started talking about some of the methodological issues in a more reflective, critical frame of mind. And one thing to get the discussion started is to make a distinction between research ethics, which many of us have to go through in doing anything to do with human participants, human subjects. So research ethics has been around for a long time, institutionalized with protocols, what is or isn't accepted. But I'm going to go beyond that. So let me start with a couple of things about research ethics. And that's a long history, more than 70 years, when the whole idea that we should be ethical in recruiting people, particularly vulnerable people. And this started with biomedical clinical research, of course, in the Nazi times, when the participants were not even giving consent to what they were being experimented on. So the vulnerability of the participants is one way that has to be protected and safeguarded through some kind of a ethical procedure. And the very first document to recognize this, and is recognized the whole world, is the Nuremberg Code, 1947, basically talking about human rights with regard to their decision to participate or not participate. So no wonder we always say you can withdraw from the experiment or the study whenever you like without giving any justifications or reasons. So that is part of the autonomy that we want to give the participants to participate or not participate in research. And the second seminal document, quite appropriately to talk about, is the Declaration of Helsinki in the 1960s. And this is one that again comes from a field of medicine, but of course has traveled to social sciences and humanities. So no wonder every association that we can think about, the sociological, anthropological, applied linguistics, or educational research, they all have somehow enshrined some kind of these basic ideas of how we can protect our participants in terms of research. So protecting research participants, that's the key from the research ethics point of view. And this has become more of a regulatory framework in any country, any university, internally and externally. And these are some of the things we often go through, and every PhD, postdoc, or whatever research we do that involves human participants, we first of all have to inform, so informed kind of a consent before we can even talk about something that we can take as a consent and accept that. So information sheets that you provide participants, what your research is about, how much you tell, how much you don't tell, that already is an ethical issue. So just to give an example, one of my PhDs, a gynecologist back in Denmark, wants to study how in the so-called clinics, sexual clinics, or sexology clinics as they're called in Denmark, when people have diabetes or chronic illnesses and they're dysfunctional in their sexual relationships. And she wanted to study whether sexual relationships are discussed adequately in the clinic. If you put that research focus in the information sheet, that will affect the nature of the data that you might collect. The doctors might already ask those things, even if they would not have done that routinely. So even what goes into an information sheet, if you are holding back something, for the reason that you don't want to put things or words in people's mouth, that is an ethical decision. So ethics in that sense, providing the information sheet, recruiting participants, informed consent procedures, protection of participants' identities and their right to withdraw. And now we have in the EU the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulations. It's very heavy-handed. Things you can do. Even if you started your PhD 3 years ago or 2 years ago, what was possible and how much information you could have disseminated through your research, you may not be able to do that now. So if you're doing very context-dependent analysis of case studies, you can't reveal about that person or about that case. So these are becoming more beyond research, actually, the whole issue of data protection and privacy. Security surrounding storage of data. That's also part of what we have to regard as crucial in research ethics. And it's not just about data collection and protection, it's also dissemination. How are we going to disseminate, to whom, and in what detail? So that also you have to declare before you can proceed with the research ethics committees and getting their approval. So that's what I would call something we are very familiar with and we have to go through whether we like it or not as part of institutional protocols. So in a nutshell, research ethics addresses issues of access, how you negotiate access to different data settings, how you recruit your participants, how you anonymize, how you protect confidentiality, and how you go about disseminating your findings and research. So that's all fine in terms of research ethics, but I don't think research ethics addresses the issue of how do we interpret the data. So is there anything that we need to declare? Of course, we say in a research protocol or a proposal, that's the kind of analysis I'll do. But is anybody going to actually check that, or do you have to get informed consent about your interpretive procedures? So somehow research ethics does not address the issue of interpretation, and that's what I want to talk about here. Even when you are recruiting participants, interpretation is involved. So the participants have to interpret the consent text, for instance. They may not understand what that text is. Their literacy level might not be sufficient to give consent. Even though they have given consent, that may not be treated as informed consent or interpreted consent, if you like. And Daniel Dennett calls this the ethics of science. Every scientific activity is an ethical project. You can't keep science and ethics separate. And research is a form of science. Interpretation is a form of science. So the more we think about anything as scientific, as our endeavor, as our enterprise, our activity, we can't separate science from ethics. And I quote, people may not be used in experiments, and you can replace experiments with any study we do, not necessarily lab-based experiments, but anything that is qualitatively data-oriented or data-conscious. People may not be used in experiments without their informed consent. And it is simply not possible to obtain informed consent without communication, without interpretation. I think that's very, almost the basic thing about can we treat, and people talk about how informed is informed consent. So people have signed a piece of document, But does it mean that they have properly understood what they're signing for or against? So any possible recruitment of participants, whether it's experimental or not, anything empirical. So I'll just replace experiment with empirical research. So can you recruit participants without communicating with them, even before we get to see how they communicate and how they use language and so on? So ethical dilemmas go beyond data collection and recruitment of participants. And that's the point of today's talk, that we must now talk about how do we go about interpreting the kind of data that we call qualitative data. And this is particularly salient or becomes more important if we are dealing with institutional professional settings within qualitative research paradigm. And just at a starting point, qualitative research is interpretive. Okay. So interpretation is the core of quality of understanding, the quality of work that we do in our research. And if it is interpretive, it's bound to be subjective and therefore biased. So every interpretive tool stands, every interpretive angle is already subjectively decided or biased. And that could be subjective in the sense it, of course, it is shared by a community, it comes from our training and exposure, but it is a subjective decision we make. Shall I do post-structuralism or shall I do ethno-methodological approach to my data? So the question I ask myself, must interpretation of qualitative data be ethically bound? Should we talk about ethics at all? Or should we just go ahead and do what we are good at? So I have been trained in this kind of interpretive inquiry or interpretive approaches, so I just do what I know. Should we ask whether it's ethical or not? And that makes me think that all empirical research is, following Sugarman, is declarative or descriptive ethics. All empirical work has an ethical dimension. So the things that we are studying, any phenomena we are trying to describe, has some moral or ethical relevance, particularly even has ethical consequences. So if the findings do have to carry beyond our research in terms of any societal change or institutional change, then we have to be accountable because our findings have made or have led to certain consequences. So empirical work is a form of descriptive ethics focused on describing a particular state of affairs that has some moral or ethical relevance or significance. So if we can break this down to very obvious questions that we can ask ourselves. Is it ethical to come to the data with a predetermined analytical framework? Actually, that can also be questioned in terms of what we call data. Okay, so we are already taking a position, taking some kind of a stance with regard to what we regard as data. But let's say that the data is what we have got, whether it's recordings, field notes, or documents, whatever they are. Can we come to those data from a preconceived, predetermined, based on our experience and training, to the data? Of course, that's what we often do. Is it ethical? What are the consequences if that is what we do for the researcher, for the researched, but also for the whole field in which we situate ourselves? Often we say that the classic distinction, dichotomy, in connecting, engaging with data, qualitative data, is whether you want to take an emic perspective, an insider perspective, or an ethic, outsider perspective. And that distinction doesn't hold all the time. What happens when you have done a huge amount of field work and ethnographic work? Are you an outsider or insider? So this distinction also doesn't carry in terms of who is an insider and who is an outsider, and when does an outsider become an insider? And in fact, the challenge for the insider is to try to distance and become an outsider you know, to interpret things objectively or not be too biased. So we refer to the notion of the Occam's razor or the principle of parsimony. The more assumptions you make in engaging with data, the less credible its explanation or explanatory power is. So making too many assumptions in the process of interpreting data, because we take so much for granted depending on which framework we are working with. So we are writing for people who believe in the kind of methodological, analytical stance or framework we are familiar with. So then we make so many assumptions. And the more assumptions we make, it reduces the credibility of the explanation or the findings that we have. And that applies to both insiders and outsiders with regard to qualitative research. So I'm asking a few more questions, then I'll hopefully get to try to engage with them. When does our interpretation of data becomes epistemologically alarming? So we can all have different ways. It's not surprising to say the same data can be interpreted from different perspectives, different angles. So you might find something and I find something else. It's the same data nonetheless. In other words, the way of looking accounts for the difference rather than the data itself. So we can tolerate and we are used to accepting that there are multiple ways of engaging with any piece of data. Is that epistemologically alarming? Should we be worried about that? So that's something we can discuss. How do we resolve or minimize when there is variability in our interpretive repertoires? So when we, and if especially if we are working together collectively, both across disciplines, all disciplines and practitioners, intellectuals and practitioners, there are bound to be differences. Who is right? How do we negotiate the meaning of our interpretations, the findings? So we talk about meaning making, shared communication is meant to be shared and negotiated. What about interpretations when it comes to data? How much can we share and negotiate the variability across interpretive repertoires? Any interpretive activity methodologically, analytically has to address the two very important pillars, important foundations, reliability and validity. Is my interpretation reliable? In other words, can it be reproduced? Can it be replicated? Is it valid? Have I got enough internal evidence in the data to support what I'm claiming? So reliability and validity, as they may be very important in quantitative research, they also are equally relevant for qualitative research. And what is reliable may not be valid. That sounds like very disturbing. But that could be exactly. So the way that inter-rater reliability does not enhance validity of the category. So 10 people can agree to call the elephant a dragon in terms of coding or categorizing, but the elephant doesn't become a dragon. Okay? So a category, inter-rater reliability, is accepted as the gold standard in much quantitative research, but it's about reliability, that the coding is reliable. But reliability does not guarantee validity. And validity is very important in qualitative research. Is it a valid category? Is it a valid claim? Even though 5 people agreed, the supervisor and the PhD student agreed on this, but that doesn't make it valid. So try to think about reliability and validity in terms of shared or unshared categorization and claims we make on the basis of the data. So like inter-rater reliability, which does not address the issue of validity, can we talk about inter-analyst validity? So we don't do rating in qualitative research. But if we come together, so we are analysts of different persuasions, of different backgrounds, of different ideologies, of different kind of presuppositions, can we then come together to make a valid claim? So in other words, if we are different in a way in how we approach the data, can we come closer? Can we approximate validity across different interpretive repertoires? Obviously, and I'm sure, and particularly I can say from my own experience, when I work with colleagues from medicine and ethics and so on, sometimes we disagree. I can point to the data, I say this is what is going on, my colleagues say no, it is not. So contested interpretation, the differences, they're not just difference, they're contested. Because you have to say who is right or who is wrong because you're writing a paper. You have to take it out to the professionals and change or do something. So contested interpretation is a likely outcome if we allow people who share a community of interest, and this is very different from community of practice, but I won't go into that. If we are interested in a particular phenomenon, but we now have two different ways of looking at it, how are we going to resolve or minimize, or who is right or who is wrong? Because you can't leave it as contested, you have to move on. So then we talk about triangulation, and I'll come to that, what we mean by that, and how that might be one way of resolving or approximating some of these contested interpretations, contested viewpoints. So the mechanisms of checks and balances, and qualitative research is not right or wrong, but how right, how much right, how much wrong, and what is the evidence. And the notion of ecological validity, so that comes back to the notion of coming away from reliability to validity, what Aaron Sickerel called ecological validity. The way in which we can make our findings more credible. It can never be absolutely accepted or kind of flawless, but we can approximate credibility. And that I'll come back to again much later, but also the notion of respondent validity. That goes back to the point I was making earlier. Do the respondents, whose data we're looking at and making sense of, do they think that's what is going on? Do they validate our interpretation, our findings? So one of the things that happens with the British Medical Journal, one of the very top journals in the field, which is published every week, okay, they have to now declare authors who submit papers, they have gained respondent validity for the paper. What that means is that the paper has been read by the people whose data you have analyzed, and they have consented to the analysis, to the interpretation. They may disagree, that doesn't matter, but they have to say that you have sent the paper to them, they have read it, and they said, okay, I disagree with point 3 and 5, but I'm happy for it to be published or to be disseminated. So that's respondent validity. And these are all problematic. What happens if somebody says, after you have done all your research, ready to be published and get your PhD, the respondents say, they could have withdrawn before participating. Now they say, I don't give consent to any of this interpretation. That's very consequential. I remember, it reminds me, when I was writing my first book in the early 90s, and a colleague of mine gave all kinds of data about her banking correspondence, about an overdraft. And I was writing a book on bureaucracy and institutions, or whatever that was. So when we analyzed the data, we anonymized the data, we gave him a name. That was not his name. He didn't like the name. He said, I hate that name. You can't call me John. I had John, my friend in the school. I hate him, so I don't want to be called John. Can you imagine what do you do? And then he wrote, I still remember in the appendix, he wrote a counter interpretation to our interpretation that was published in the main part of the book. So he disagreed with our analysis, and we gave him the space. to give his counter-interpretation, and it's part of the book. So that's the kind of thing that when people whose lives you are interpreting through the data that we call our data, it's actually their data, not our data. If they disagree in what you call them and how you read in their intentions, or how do you categorize, you call this something with a jargon or some technical term, they say, I was not doing that. I was not doing positive politeness. I don't know what positive politeness is. What do you do? So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, that how can we, first of all, recruit our respondents and validate our analysis even before we get to the readers and to the others. So those kind of things that we can talk about. Let me give you two very concrete examples. I have done a lot of work in the context of genetic counseling. And while I was getting all the data, here is one counselor, and this is exactly what he said. I give you consent to record my clinic, but not how you interpret. That's interesting. So that means that we don't declare how we interpret. And people are very worried, particularly in institutional settings, if I start interpreting his work as paternalistic, as anti-human, or not patient-centered, because I could try and see some of those things in the data, depending on how I interpret the data. But when he said, I don't give you the license to interpret the way you want because it has consequences. Suppose your interpretation reaches my manager, and my manager reads that my clinics are too paternalistic or too directive or whatever. Is it ethical? And that's a different issue about ethics of disseminating our findings, which I won't go into. But that also says, do we have the interpretive license, like a poetic license? Can we be as creative or as we wish, whatever we can to do to our data? So do we have the authority for an unconditional interpretation of the data? Or is it conditional upon something? So in other words, are we free to choose what interpretive frameworks we bear or we bring to the data? And that might be fine, whatever you choose, in the context of your academic circle, publications, research profiles, and trajectories. But I'm going beyond that. What does it mean for the people whose data you are interpreting, which has consequences? So even when we talk about transcribing data, that's already interpretation. Field notes are already interpretations. So Malinowski said that every field note we keep is already biased. It's selective. You can't write down everything that's going on. So you're already selecting what is interpretively salient. And he talked about the tutored eye. Even ethnographers and field workers must be trained how to do field notes. Not everybody can do field notes, but we assume, just as we get in, all are good field workers and field note takers. Because that also needs tutoring your eyes, how to see and what not to interpret. So transcription of recorded data or ethnographic field notes, they are already forms of interpretation. And here is one example of a very well-known psychotherapist and counselor, and I was recording her clinic to work together, and I thought we'll look at the data together and write a paper jointly. When I arrived with the data, very sophisticated in the transcription with pauses and overlaps and so on, she looked at it and said, is this what you call data? That was amazing. And what she was questioning is, basically, I think what she said, if I recall, if this is what you call data, I'm out. I don't want to participate in this kind of research, this kind of activity, because I don't treat this as data, however sophisticated it might be. I can't see the emotions in the data. I still remember the clinic. And it was a very traumatic clinic of a very young journalist who had a genetic condition. He will turn blind, you know, gradually. And that means not only he will be blind, and whatever that means in terms of his life and quality of life, but he will lose his job as a journalist, because you have to have eyes to become a journalist. And that consultation was so traumatic. She said, if you ask the walls, they remember what happened, but I don't see it in the data, the tears, the emotions, and the stress, and all the things. So how can you make any claims on the basis of a transcript, which is very sophisticated on pauses and turn-taking and, you know, overlaps, but doesn't have those things that I remember from that consultation? So if this is the data and that's your disciplinary background, that's how you work, I'm not going to collaborate. And she never did. She gave me consent to write the paper and publish, but she didn't want to be a joint author because she didn't trust that this is the kind of data she could analyze or interpret. So these are the four different ethical positions I take about the qualitative research or the different steps: the ethics of access or the observer's paradox, the ethics of participation in the data collection itself, interviews and recordings, ethnography and so on. There are degrees of participation and socialization. So that's also ethically grounded, how you position yourself. How do you dress yourself when you are doing ethnographic work in a clinic as opposed to in a classroom, for instance? I remember one of my colleagues refused entry to one of my PhD students to his clinic because he was shabbily dressed. That if the patients look at you, they might think somebody has just, a mad person has come in. You have to wear a tie. If you want to do ethnography, you have to be part of this environment. That's interesting as a requirement, or at least he thought that would be relevant. So the ethics of participation and what I call the participant's paradox, what we'll discuss today, the ethics of interpretation, and the analyst's paradox. And the ethics of dissemination or intervention, and the paradox of rigor and relevance, which I will not talk about today. But these are the four different steps, if you like, the cycles that we can talk about. And by calling these paradoxes, I'm already very aware none of these paradoxes can be resolved. We can only appreciate and try to approximate or to minimize some of the effects rather than resolve. There is no way of resolving or solving these paradoxes. And just very briefly, what I mean by ethics, because that's the kind of core here. Ethics are two axes, the good and bad and the right and wrong. So it is not just good and bad. So sometimes you might do something wrong, but it's good. Sometimes you might do something bad, but that's right for that occasion, for that moment, for that context, for that person. So you can think of many examples in life which is not just good, bad. And this is where it becomes complex. When you try to calibrate across these two axes, good and bad, and right and wrong, then everything is posed as a dilemma. You have to make a choice. But everything that you choose, an alternative could have been better or not so good. But that is partly why we call it ethical dilemmas. And science is inseparable from ethics. Therefore, science of interpretation, the rigor we bring to the data, we want to be rigorous. A very typical comment in the world of journals, articles, the analysis is too, it's not rigorous enough, not systematic, not rigorous, it's just paraphrasing and glossing. So the more we try to achieve rigor, which is what we want to prioritize and privilege, then we might be not so relevant, or we might be entering into some kind of ethical dilemmas. So rigor and ethics may not go hand in hand. Okay, so let me go through a few more ideas about ethics of interpretation. I'm beginning with a philosopher of science, Einar Hansen. And the idea and what he calls your perception, you can replace it with interpretation. Okay. So interpretation of perception is intertwined with concepts. And he makes the very key point that any observation, any interpretation is theory laden, is led by theory. There is no such thing as phenomenal seeing. So you see something already influenced, biased by your readings, your training, your way of looking, your way of seeing. And then he goes on to make a very useful distinction between seeing as and seeing that. Seeing as is like the camera recording, reporting, without being mediated. Seeing that is mediated seeing. There's something that is mediating between you and the thing, the phenomena you are seeing, the entity you are seeing. It's a matter of logic, not merely a matter of fact, that seeing as and seeing that are indispensable to science, what is called observation in science or observational science. And that's the distinction he clarifies. Seeing that threads knowledge into our seeing. So we bring some knowledge, some theory into the process of seeing and looking at the data. So that's seeing in terms of interpreting or analyzing the data. It saves us from re-identifying everything that meets our eye. So no wonder something stands out from the data to somebody very differently to somebody else, because that's what we have come to see. We have come to the data to see something that's already in our theoretical predisposition. It allows physicists to observe new data as physicists. I think this is a very crucial point. We always analyze data as critical discourse analysts, as conversation analysts, as systemic functional linguists. So actually we position ourselves already that. So therefore, the way in which we look at data is always as something. And that's the seeing that. So physicists don't look at data as cameras do. Observation in physics is not an encounter with unfamiliar and unconnected flashes, sounds and bumps, but rather a calculated meeting with these as flashes, sounds and bumps of a particular kind. It's a type token. Okay? So we already have a type. We are interpretive types. So when we get to some data, we see this as a token of the type we believe in, we are comfortable with. And that's perfectly acceptable in our community of practice. I'm not saying we should not do all these things. I'm just raising this to a level of discussion and some kind of a critical awareness. It's nothing wrong by becoming and claiming yourself with a level called critical discourse analyst or corpus linguist or whatever. That's not an issue here. The thing is, then we have to accept that we're coming to the data as a corpus linguist, as a critical discourse analyst, as an ethnographer, as an ethnomethodologist, whatever that might be. So we come to the data and we see the data as of a particular kind, that the thing that we believe typically in. And that challenges the whole idea of what is data-driven or what is empiricism. So if you go back to the Lockean empiricism, that the light arises from the nature of things themselves. The data speaks to you. Okay? So the bottom up, the kind of things that we almost take for granted, that the data, things come out of the data. How does it come out? And why does it come out differently to different people, the same data? So light doesn't arise from the things themselves. We begin to put light on things as we like or as we feel comfortable. And that's the paradox of empiricism in essence. So we're talking about if we come to our empirical data with our experience, And here I take experience as our training. So we are trained in a particular analytical methodological tradition, that's fine. But that's our experience. So if experience is said to be the source of knowledge, then every valid claim to knowledge will satisfy some empirical criteria. And it is those criteria which will then validate the knowledge. So that's the paradox, that you already validate your knowledge in terms of what you knew before you got to the new knowledge. So we only can validate new knowledge on the basis of our experience. So actually we are constrained by our training and experience. So the validity of the knowledge are derived from the criteria of our experience. And that is a cycle or a paradox as Chisholm begins to think. Empiricism thus begins paradoxically with a general premise. So empiricism is not totally open-minded. It's already, there are certain criteria that are ingrained in the way what we call data, how we interpret, how we categorize. These are already somehow based on our experience. So the experience is the basis of our knowledge. The knowledge is not in the data itself. I think that's very interesting to think about. Then we begin in more closer home to working with interaction, language, communication, and so on. We might say we must not have a motivation. We don't bring anything. So this is the tabula rasa, that we don't bring anything into the data. So the typical position that somebody like Harvey Sachs, the ethnomethodology and conversational analysis would take, is if we pick any data without bringing any problems to it, we'll find something. And you can actually extend that. Can you actually, even if you don't have a problem, can you get rid of the way you are going to look at the data? Okay. So you may not be thinking about risk or empowerment or feminism. That's fine. You don't have some kind of a biased topic in your head. But still, your analytic stance is already predetermined. The fact that I will transcribe the data with the pauses marked is already a bias. So that kind of a bias you cannot just leave out and say, I'm not motivated. But he claimed, and many people claim, that CA, conversational analysis, ethnomethodology, is unmotivated. There's no motive whatsoever. Others, like myself and many others, would say it is motivated. Whether you're doing critical discourse analysis, you're doing feminism, you're doing postmodernism, or whatever, it's already motivated, what you want to find in the data. So sometimes, by directing our analytic attention to some things, not the others, because you can't, you are bound to be selective. So that process of channeling our interest in the data in one way rather than another, so I might only focus on the collective pronouns we, everything else goes, I don't care. So that kind of a selection is already motivated. And this kind of motivated looking, based on experience, our training, from where we come from, is unavoidable. It is not only unavoidable, I would even go further and say it's desirable. Because we can't do everything. So oftentimes we find we have far more data than we can actually manage, we can actually digest, even whether it's a PhD or a project or whatever. We have masses of data. So we have to be selective, and therefore there is a desire to focus on something at the expense of something else. But even when you take an analytic stance that I will analyze the data sequentially or collocationally in a corpus linguistics framework, I will only look at the context or co-text up to this. For me, context only means the preceding turn and the next turn. These are decisions that we make based on our experience and training, but that's already motivated. So when we freeze data and we say, okay, I'll do micro-analysis of the data by playing the video 15 times, that's already motivated because you want to see something more specifically in that little fragment. It can't be unmotivated in that sense. And both motivated and unmotivated looking can border on overinterpretation. So we might be interpreting more than necessary. We might be over-socializing, over-biologizing, over-psychologizing, over-linguisticizing, whatever that is. Whatever discipline we come from, we only see that. It becomes a mirror. The data is a mirror through which we see our disciplinary interests, our disciplinary habitus, if you like. So what Kenneth Burke said, that we create, we spread a terministic screen over the data. So what becomes relevant is on the basis of the way in which we use terms and concepts to make sense of the data. So that's the terministic screen that is being stressed over not just what, how we define ourselves, what is critical sociolinguistics, what is what's the variationist sociolinguistics. So we define these categories and these fields on the basis of the terminology that we devise. So the categories that we devise within the subdisciplines create that screen. So it defines where is our speciality and what lies outside, or what is the boundary of what we know. I was thinking of Goffman's notion of the sins of non-contextuality. And then I thought, and I will claim authorship to what is in the next paragraph called the sins of contextuality. So when Goffman was talking about sins of non-contextuality, was precisely the point, the part cannot stand for the whole. The more we become microscopic and look at something in a very sophisticated way, but it's only a bit in the microscope, it cannot stand on its own. And it says very little unless we embed it in the bigger picture, whatever that is. So the sense of non-contextuality is the assumption that bits of conversation can be analyzed in their own right, in some independence of what was occurring in that time and place. So the whole conversation, the whole party, rather than just a fragment. But now we can extend that to the sense of contextuality. When we define the context, what counts as the context, we don't agree what is context. So the more we talk about context dependence, we account for the context as much as we can. Well, what is that context? Because if I'm a conversation analyst, the context is very narrowly defined according to the terms before and after. If I'm a critical discourse analyst, the context is the whole sociopolitical spectrum. So what is the context? And if we define that this is how or what we mean by the context, we might also be committing the sins of contextuality, as like non-contextuality. This is a colleague with whom I worked for a long time, a geneticist, and he said, and he wrote, interpretation of professional behavior, and especially any attempt to evaluate professional behavior. So both description and evaluation, if you're evaluating or assessing teachers, not just describing practices. So sometimes we say, we are only interested in the description of practices. But I don't think you can keep that away from being evaluative, having some kind of an assessment built into the description. It can only sensibly proceed with some input from the professional. So we need to work together to make the interpretations tally or aligned. This is not to say that a professional's account of their practice must be taken at face value. Of course, they might be justifying what they did, even though that is not what you would like to believe. But an attempt to make any sense of practice, professional practice, without some input from professionals is unlikely to be productive. In other words, it will not make any difference to the profession. They are not going to change their practice or even feel that this is credible evidence to think or to take things forward. So then it begins to ask questions about things that we take for granted. I'm doing ethnography, so I'm a fly on the wall. Can anybody be a fly on the wall? Is that something that is already in everybody's human nature? I don't think so. And even more challengingly, sometimes it's better to be a flying fly than a fly on the wall. The more you become a walled fly, don't move, the more you might affect the encounter. People begin to suspect, are you not a human being? You don't breathe and your eyelids don't flip. So actually there are risks about being a fly on the wall. But what makes us think that being a fly on the wall gives us the affordance of interpretation? So this comment is about if I'm a fly on the wall, meaning an outsider in the psychotherapy clinic, you can analyze the conversation to bits, sequentially and otherwise, but you may not know that we're doing psychotherapy. That's not necessarily embedded in the interaction. Or even if it is, you don't have the capacity to understand, which is not manifest. So these outside researchers would see and hear an ordinary conversation, turn-taking, everything else, questions, answers, whatever it is that interests us. But what defines the conversation as psychotherapy might be missed. It might not be simply there to be interpreted. And this is Michael Moorman, who tried to bring together conversational analysis and ethnomethology and ethnography together. He said, even if you observe some practices in an exotic place, as ethnographers would do, what makes you think that you have the ability to interpret a practice? So the example he was giving was dating in a very the Lao community in Thailand. And one of the things he noticed was people would date on a Friday night. But if it is a date, an invitation to date on a Friday night, then it is something serious, not on Thursday nights. Even if the language, the linguistic practices are exactly the same. How do we know, and that's what we would call the native knowledge or the knowledge of the people, how can we access covert knowledge of that underlying practices? So practices don't speak. We can observe practices, we can record practices, but there is something implicit, there is something covert. And how much of that covert knowledge is accessible at the level of what we call data, and then having called it data, to interpret it, to make sense of it. So then thick participation becomes almost a precondition for thick description. But that's a questionable thing. What counts as thick participation? Is it just doing and going to the same place every week? Or is it something else that you almost go beyond being an outsider to becoming an insider? And there are two paradoxes here we can talk about, the abstractionism and analysis, if you like. So if we try to understand any human conduct, any human behavior or action, at whatever level of generality, we have to somewhere start at the everyday, mundane understanding of performance and practice and actions. Otherwise, we might be accused of just abstracting. So that's the fallacy of abstractionism in terms of we are only operating at the level of the types and typologies rather than the tokens. But if you take the other extreme, the paradox of microanalysis, a bit like the sins of non-contextuality that Goffman talked about, the more and more we try to look more microscopically into something, that may be distorted when those specific events become the primary focus of investigation. I think that's, to me, is very telling. The more we prioritize what we interpret, and that has to be done microscopically, then we have somehow eliminated or avoided looking at something else. And how can we convince ourselves and the participants that a fine-grained analysis, a microscopic analysis, is always better. So a microscope might be very good for doing certain things, but it's totally useless for reading a novel or something else. So the tool itself is not entirely competent or efficient for the kind of things we want to do. But if we have been defined by the tools we have, in other words, the analytical frameworks, then we will bound to take it where we go. So I'll try to go through. How am I doing time wise? Because I'll stop in 10 minutes. Would that be okay? Okay, so I'll just go through this a little bit more so then we can have some discussions. What I call the analyst paradox, that sometimes we may need the help of our participants, in some cases more than in other cases, to make valid claims, rather than saying, I am the best analyst, the most rigorous, sophisticated analysis on earth, and I will make interpretations, and that's valid. And of course, this paradox is a continuum. I am very challenged when I try to analyze the talks between geneticists, or a geneticist and a kidney specialist and a neurosurgeon. Now I can't understand, even if it is the language expert I am. So the more you go to the backstage of practice, the less we have the ability to interpret what's going on, despite our knowledge of the language and the content. So analyst paradox as a continuum, it's at its most extreme when interpreting different practices, organizational professional practices, which is backstage, like case records, peer center talk, case conferences, source texts, guidance notes, and so on. And then we have the paradox within the paradox, when you ask your participants what's going on here, and they can't articulate. So that's the implicit knowledge, the tacit knowledge that every practitioner, every person has. They can't. So interview then is not a method of access to that kind of knowledge, because they can't tell you exactly what was going on. So the more we get into the local native knowledge at the tacit, implicit level, it cannot be accessed or cannot be articulated by the participants themselves. So I said that there is no such thing as just description. All descriptions are somehow evaluative, even if not intended as such. And this is just a very brief example of how this could happen. So when I was looking at some data in the genetics clinics, there was something that we, as a group of discourse analysts, called therapeutic frame. Okay, so that's a label we gave to types of data or the types of interaction. It was intended as therapeutic. And frame is a very useful concept we all use in discourse analytic work. So we called it therapeutic frame. Then we presented our work to our fellow geneticists and genetic counselors. They said, you can't call what we do therapeutic. We don't do therapy. It's not psychotherapy. Genetic counseling is not psychotherapy. So therapy as a word doesn't belong to us. It's totally alienating what we do. Despite my showing them the evidence from literature, what that means and how many people have used that term. Okay. So there are two things that my colleague said. One, we don't do it, so your category is not valid, even if it is reliable. Remember the reliability and validity. So I can rely, this category is reliable because I can cite so many literature and I can give definitions. But that's not a valid category because it doesn't make sense to them, despite what I'm saying. And the second thing, and very useful thing they said, if you use that term in your academic writing and publications, you will never get published in a genetics journal. And even if you do get published in a non-genetics journal, no genetic counselor would read it. It's not a keyword that would go across the border. It will not translate. That raises very interesting issues about even if we have a terminology and a concept, but now it cannot translate beyond our community of practice. That's a challenge. When we called it reflective talk rather than therapeutic talk, it was exactly the same phenomena. It's like a find and replace in a Word document. And that was totally acceptable. It didn't make any difference to our findings. In fact, it added value to our findings because they could accept it. So reflective talk, yes, but not therapeutic. Likewise, a label called normalization is already ideologically powerful. So normalization of experience and expectation, what we call the patients are doing or the clients are doing, that was not acceptable either. Instead, when you say adjustment of some kind or accommodation or psychosocial aspect or something else, not normalization, any ization becomes problematic. But having, with the first description, when we changed the label from therapeutic to reflective, it made no difference to the findings. But when we changed the normalization to adjustment, actually our earlier findings didn't stick anymore. They were no longer seen in the data. Because having called it adjustment, we had a completely different frame of looking at the data to find evidence. In other words, it changed our way of looking because of the terminology, because of that category. And not only that, it even helped us to have subcategories rather than calling everything normalization. So normalization turned out to be an umbrella category, which was not helping us to find subtypes or subcategories. By calling it adjustment and accommodation, actually it ended up by saying, okay, people or clients, when they get a bad news about their condition, they don't normalize in the same way. And we could find different types of articulations or patients and how they respond. So finally, this is something that to kind of summarize what I've been saying is we are bound to have blind spots in when we're doing qualitative research. So by the time we engage in the most sophisticated way, something escapes our interpretation, our landscape. So whether it is the gaze that might be very intent, that might be quite sophisticated, but the blind spots always escape. And this is how we often talk about qualitative inquiry through metaphors. The metaphor of the toolbox, we have the tools, and the metaphor of the lens or gaze. So analytic lens, analytic gaze, or the methodological toolbox, analytic toolbox. Those are the two types of metaphors we might want to think about as our interpretive take on our data. And this is what Abraham Maslow called the law of the hammer. That it is tempting, if the only thing you have is a hammer, everything you look at is a nail. In other words, the methodology, the toolbox, determines or decides or influences what is data and what is your finding. So it is not data-driven. It is tool-driven. It's instrument-driven. It is our analytical stance-driven. So this is the law of the hammer, which actually goes back to what is called the law of the instrument. And I think that is very true of most qualitative research. We have instruments, analytical instruments. And these instruments then can be very instrumental in their use, and therefore very narrow. We might over-rely because that's the only thing we have. That's the only tool we have. And no wonder, and it will be fascinating to see how many people actually shift their analytical methodological position during their professional career. Very few. So if you are a corpus linguist, you remain a corpus linguist for most of your life, or critical discourse analyst, or CA, or whatever. So that's an interesting way that we probably try to over-rely, because that sounds familiar. We feel comfortable. That's our comfort zone. And of course, we know another one would have the same problems and biases and limitations. So it's not as if you can swap for a worse instrument for a better one. Every instrument has to have its own limitations. And that's characteristic of any scientific inquiry, whether qualitative or quantitative. And in qualitative, we basically say that we make our analytic instruments our focal interest. So sometimes it is, I was just thinking in a scenario when I talk to PhD students first time encounters, I ask them, so tell me about yourself. I'm fascinated the differences in which they do their identity work. Some people would say, oh, I do corpus-informed CDA. That's the first sentence. I was not prepared for it. I would rather like, as it turns out, this person who said I'm doing corpus-informed CDA is actually looking at what is called a phenomenon in China called leftover women. These are women who have been divorced, leftover food, leftover women. It's a fascinating topic. I never heard about this. So I would have thought that would be the first thing this person would say. I'm looking at the predicament of leftover women, or the taboos, or the stigma, or whatever, why this happens in China more than anywhere else. But that didn't come out in the first sentence. It is actually corpus-informed CDA or something. So that, interestingly, is the way in which we make our focal interest the instrument, the methodology, rather than the what. And if we, and that is, again, something I'm not saying good or bad, but I'm saying the more we do that, then the what would take a backseat, would not be contributing to that kind of debate in the society or outside of academia. And that's the crux of many methodological analytical traditions, that we first find ourselves, our feet, our identity in a methodological tradition, analytical tradition, and then the what comes. So whether I'm doing classroom or identity or risk or empowerment, that comes next, but not primarily. And the constructs and categories that underpin our interpretation, they can reveal something about the micro phenomena, of course, but at the same time, they can blind us to what else might be going on. And this is an art critic, John Berger. In fact, the book is called The Ways of Seeing, which became a BBC documentary. And he says, we only see what we look at. To look is an act of choice. As a result of this act, what we see is brought within our reach, though not necessarily within arm's reach. So basically, we choose how or what we look at, and that's the only thing we see. And very classic statement from Kenneth Burke, every way of seeing is also a way of not seeing. So we need a lot of tolerance of different interpretive repertoires. Let me stop with this from Gilbert and Mulcahy, the classic book, Opening the Pandora's Box. And I think this is pause for thought and reflection. That sometimes you might want to make your description, interpretation definitive. We want to make it definitive, not tentative, provisional. But the more definitive you make it, the more risky it is. And this is, and I quote, interpretation is indeterminate. All interpretation is indeterminate. It is provisional. Especially in relation to intentionality underpinning participants' communicative behavior or practices. There are intentions behind those practices. We can never be sure what those intentions are, even when you do ethnography year around. Such indeterminate accounts, that's what we produce as our analysis, as our data, interpretation, may be seen as unsatisfactory because you are not determinate, you are not fixed, you are not rigid, you are not claiming anything black and white. But the alternative to give any definitive account of persons will be equally unsatisfactory or even more unsatisfactory because they imply unjustifiably that the analyst can reconcile his version of events with all the multiple and divergent versions generated by the actors themselves. So in fact, there is a reason not to sound more determinate, not to sound more definite, because the more definitive you become, the more you might be moving away from the nuances that underpin what the participants stand for, what the participants are going to look at. I don't know what the next slide is. Oh, yes, okay. Because I had raised the issue of when should we be worried about our interpretation as being epistemologically alarming. Okay. And this is what John Donne, another philosopher, says, or what he calls descriptive discretion. We are all giving descriptions of what we see. Are we discretionary in our descriptions? Because alternative descriptions are possible. And this is what he says. The prevalence of descriptive discretion is not in itself epistemologically alarming. I think we have come to accept in qualitative research, in whatever field we work in, that your interpretation will be different from mine. And we don't have to get into a fight who is right. And I'm not carrying a pistol to shoot you because your interpretation doesn't align with mine. Okay. So that's something we have got used to. But is it epistemologically worrying, troubling us? So prevalence of descriptive discretion is not in itself epistemologically alarming, though it does weaken the prospects of any very crisply incremental development of the social sciences. And that's the big difference between science and social science, that our knowledge is not incremental. It can be diverse, it can be dispersed, it can go in different tangential ways. It doesn't necessarily build as it happens in normal science. In itself, it comes no closer to imperiling the reality of human performance than variations in the taste of landscape artists, than the variations in the taste of landscape artists come to altering the physical properties of mountains. So variationism is fine, we can tolerate and we can live with. Just like artists, landscape artists, can paint the landscape slightly variant, slightly different. It doesn't necessarily have epistemological alarm. To make it epistemologically alarming, meaning our description, when did it become epistemologically alarming, not just methodological trouble, it would be necessary for it to extend to the assertion and negation of the same description, identically interpreted, of the same phenomena by two different competent, sincere, attentive observers. I think it goes back to where I started about inter-analyst validity. So if we too regard ourselves as most experienced and trained and senior in this kind of a way of analyzing things, but we disagree, that would be epistemological alarming, not somebody coming from another analytic tradition. So are we prepared for that kind of? And I think I'll just close this. I remember once when I was younger and enthusiastic and ambitious, not anymore, neither of those three. I'm not young, not ambitious, not enthusiastic anymore. I remember when I was getting to the stepping stones of academia, having done a PhD. It's fascinating that Norman Fairclough, or maybe I should go off record. Can we turn this off? This is interesting when you want